You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. No Mena van Praagh with me today, I'm afraid. Mena's elsewhere, but Mena fans need not worry. She appears later on in spirit when she interviews screenwriter Pilar Alessandra. We also have a chat with various authors who have written work for an anthology to celebrate the life and work of Sir Terry Pratchett. And our studio guest today is former Home Secretary Charles Clarke. Charles, hello, welcome to Bookmark.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
I say former Home Secretary, former politician. Is a politician ever really former?
You're quite right, I don't think they ever are. Politics is something that goes on almost whatever you do in life, and it's just a question of what role you choose to play. I'm doing most of my work now in the academic field and doing writing in various ways, but politics is never far from that.
And you lost your seat in, was it 2010?
Yeah.
By 300 votes. So you were almost in there. 310 votes. Does that make it worse somehow?
Well, it's interesting. I very much miss being MP for Norwich. I enjoyed it a lot. I miss being government. I don't miss Parliament so much. And so Parliament in opposition is quite a depressing kind of place. So I wouldn't say I miss that. And I think I've enjoyed the life I've been able to find after that, though the result itself was a shock at the time.
You're still a very recognisable figure, though. Do people still, you know, collar you at parties and say what you did on tuition fees and all that kind of thing?
They certainly do. It's exactly what you did just in the studio. I call them finger popers. They say, Mr. Clarke, what we want to say is this. And it's about any kind of subject, some good, some bad, but people certainly do. And in many ways, I enjoy that. Even when I'm walking from A to B, people come up and say, well, what about this? What about that? And I think that's a good thing about our democracy, actually, is that people feel able to talk to the people who've been politicians about what's going on.
And when you're looking at politics now, when you're watching it on TV, either in the House of Commons or watching the news, can you help yourself? Do you feel, you know, I would have done that differently, or I would have said that differently?
I do feel that. I feel that both looking at government ministers as to how they're operating, and particularly the roles I held, looking at Theresa May as Home Secretary and now Nicky Morgan as Education Secretary, I think, well, would I do it like this? But also on the Labour Party, which, as you know, has been going through an enormous disruption over the last year or so, feeling a combination of hope and despair at what I see. And you can't avoid that, and I wouldn't seek to, really. I think the idea politics is something you do and then it stops and then it's completely gone is not really realistic.
Well, we're going to be asking you about the Labour Party and particularly the leaders of the Labour Party as the show progresses. But we'll start now with your first piece of music. We'll give you a proper introduction as well in just a moment. But your first piece of music, Kenny Rogers, The Gambler. Why have you chosen this?
For two reasons. One, it really reminds me of a great first real holiday we had with our children when they were quite grown up. We went to America, and as we drove across America, we were playing Kenny Rogers, The Gambler, all the time, and the whole family loved it, and it reminds me of that, which I very much enjoyed. Secondly, the lyrics about gambling and about the choices you make, I think, are quite thought-provoking, and I've always enjoyed that.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness till boredom overtook us. And he began to speak. He said, son, I've made a life out of reading.
That was The Gambler by Kenny Rogers, the first choice of music today from our studio guest, Charles Clarke. Charles was MP for Norwich South from 1997 to 2010. He was Secretary of State for Education and Skills from 2002 to 2004, and then Home Secretary till 2006. In 2014, he edited and contributed to the book The Too Difficult Box, The Big Issues Politicians Can't Crack. And he's also edited and contributed to a series of books looking at leadership and more specifically the individual leaders over time of the three main political parties. So let's talk about The Too Difficult Box first, Charles. How did that come about, that book?
We ran a series of lectures at the University of East Anglia, where I'm a visiting professor. And they were focused on why was it that we had not succeeded, the Labour government had not succeeded in making big changes in some of the areas where people hoped we would. Why was there a sense of disappointment? I think that the Labour government's achievements were very substantial, but nevertheless, there's no doubt that in areas like reform of the welfare state, immigration, poverty and so on, there hadn't been the progress that people hoped. And people's thought that it was because of a lack of will to do it. There's an argument that if you were serious enough about doing it, you'd really make it happen. But what I asked a whole series of lecturers to do was to talk about the problems there really were in trying to make change in a given area, the various stages as you went through. And that was an excellent set of lectures, which emerged with a number of common themes, like the fact that many of these problems are long-term problems and we have a very short-term political system which just operates on the immediate term. It talks about the difficulty of having a very adversarial system of politics where there isn't an effort to try and find a common purpose to solve some of the difficulties we face. And so I decided to take it forward as a book, and there was an interest in doing that. And so we turned the lectures into chapters of the book. And there are a series of very interesting discussions about particular aspects of this. And I felt very pleased with the book because it was trying to say, actually, if politics is to succeed in mobilising people, it must solve the problems that people are worried about. And to the extent it fails to do so, people will turn away and look to alternatives in this country like UKIP or the SNP in some circumstances, in Greece, Syriza, in America, the Tea Party movement, in France, the National Front. Because if people feel that politics can't properly solve the problems they're experiencing in their day-to-day lives, then they turn away, quite understandably so. And the responsibility for that is with the politicians who aren't solving the problems about which they're exercised.
So the chapter headings, so you've got things like nuclear disarmament, climate change, welfare, banking and ageing population. These are all the issues that were identified as too difficult, in other words.
Exactly.
Take
the ageing population, for example. Obviously, we live in an ageing population, but our lecturer there, Jeff Filkin, who wrote the chapter, who's campaigned on this over a long period of time, discovered that the National Health Service has absolutely no projection plans for what to do, what will be the health needs of the population as it gets older. Now, this is almost unbelievable if you think what the situation might be. There are a whole set of very difficult problems. Where should the pension age be? When do contributions start? How do you operate? What are the ways of dealing with social care in old age as people's health needs can become more acute and we get more and more people over 80, even over 90? And how does the society deal with that? And the starting point is you have to think about the problem and think what the solutions are. And that, in the case of ageing society, isn't really happening. But then the next stage is, having thought about it, having got some clear idea what the solutions might be, you then have to get people working together to try and solve it. And the principles I've just described apply in those other areas you mentioned as well.
I was going to say, are there common factors running through all the things that were identified? Because they're complex issues, but everything you deal with in politics is complex. Are there certain common themes to those really just hard to crack nuggets?
Well, that point you just made is extremely important. They are complicated problems, and there's always saloon bar solutions where you sit around and say, if only you did this, we could sort it out. Actually, they are all complicated, but there are some important common themes. First most important common theme is it is a long-term question which involves a whole series of elements of society working together to try and address it. And those two statements themselves, long-term and people working together, are of themselves quite antipathetic to the current political system that we have at the moment. We have a political system which is highly short-term. It's even what's on the telly the next morning. And also where conflict is built into politics, often conflict at very trivial levels, which means it's very difficult to get the common sense of direction about what needs to go. And so the central call that emerged from this whole set of lectures was that we have to develop different ways of politics to deal with these issues.
Yes, you say in the book, politicians need to develop long-term culture to deal with long-term problems. And but how can you when, as you say, it's built into the system, we have an election every 5 years? You describe yourself as an optimist. You need to be an optimist to be that, really. Can you see light at the end of the tunnel?
I can, and I am an optimist. There are occasions when progress is made in particular ways. There has been some progress, for example, on trying to fund care in old age as a result of political leaders coming together and saying we need to work in a better way to try and address these situations. Even on funding of the health service, which is a very important long-term issue, which we didn't actually cover in that particular book, there is a general consensus that we need to keep on putting in money at a significant level to try and deal with it. But I would say there are areas where there has been a sense of common determination, but nothing like enough. If you take a much more difficult problem like immigration, for example, the countries which have been far more successful at dealing with that, countries like Canada and Spain, it's because the main political forces have said we have to work together to address this problem rather than picking points of difference. And whereas in this country, we seem to just have arguments about how to deal with it all the time. So I think there are signs of positiveness in some areas, but I would say far too limited. But the optimism in me says, well, we can get people to work together to try and address some of these issues.
Is there an issue also that people look to politicians to solve everything, and even to admit that something is too difficult to solve is quite a bold statement?
You're quite right, and I've been very surprised about that. I don't think it's very difficult to say the problem's too difficult, but undoubtedly there's a macho element in politics which says, oh no, we can do everything, and that if you don't say you can do everything, then people will look down on you. But I think the truth is the other way around. I think that if you say you're going to solve things in a certain way and then don't, despair and alienation sets in place and contempt for the politician starts to arise. So I think you have to start from saying what you can do, what you can't do, and then say, how do we solve what we can't do?
It's a difficult line to tread, though, isn't it? Because people do look to politicians to have all the answers. You are only human beings. You have amazing resources, but at the end of the day, you are making a decision based on facts like we do all the time.
That is completely true. And it's also true that it's an illusion to think that any politician can say, OK, we're going to do that, off we go, that's what we do, and then it is all done. If you wanted to get, everybody performing better in school, in 25,000 schools in Britain, the people who make that happen are the teachers, the governors of the school, the parents, a whole range of people working together to try and improve reading and writing or whatever it may happen to be. And that's not something any politician can in Downing Street say, OK, we're going to ensure all children read better. Because actually it requires everybody to pull together. And I think that's true in most of the areas in our democratic society, that it does require people to work together. And that's not always an easy thing to do. The media climate sometimes makes that more difficult as well. And so building a sense of common purpose becomes extremely important.
Well, we're going to come back to that, and we're also going to look at the issue of leadership, which you've also written about. Just before we went on, we were talking about Terry Pratchett. We're just going to hear a series of interviews now about a book published in memory of him, and you were saying what an extraordinary character he was. Did you ever meet him?
I met him once. We were doing the Daily Politics, a TV programme, and he came on. And I thought his courage in discussing his condition and what needed to be done was absolutely exemplary. And what it did, because of his determination, was to bring together people to say, really, we've got to try and do better at solving this particular medical condition in the way that we did. And I thought he was inspirational, really. I mean, his as a writer, he wasn't really my style. I didn't read him a lot. But as a person, I thought he was exemplary.
Inspirational, you say. Well, yes, as you may remember, the Discworld author Sir Terry Pratchett died in March 2015. A group of writers have come together to publish an anthology of comic stories as a tribute to Sir Terry and to raise money for Alzheimer's Research UK. In Memory features the work of 17 writers and their unique take on the theme of memory. It includes short stories from authors living in Canada, Germany and the Netherlands, as well as the UK. I went along to the launch of the book in Cambridge late late last year. So I'm sitting around a table with Lottie, Rob, Michael and Laura. They're all contributors to this anthology, In Memory, a tribute to Sir Terry Pratchett. Lottie, how old are you?
I'm 17.
And what was it about Terry Pratchett that appealed to you?
I love his characterisation and just the character of Mort. It's just such an interesting idea, and I would have never thought about death in that way.
Rob, is there a particular book of Terry Pratchett's that you like?
To be honest, I like most of it. I've read a lot of them from an early age. My mum was a big fan, which got me into them through that. But I've just always enjoyed, particularly the books about the watch and so on. I just love the sort of dirty cop fantasy setting. It always spoke to me. I always enjoyed it. I found it funny and insightful.
And Michael, you're nodding there. What is it about him that really appeals to you?
Well, I think it's fascinating how he's able to build a world and add layers of complexity. Because at first it looks like it's really just a funny story, but you look closer and you see really social topics everywhere. And I was nodding because the first book I ever read was Men at Arms, which is from The Watch.
First one I read as well.
And I was hooked.
What makes him different, do you think?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think he's an author who really thinks a lot about what he's writing. He's just not trying to write a funny book. He's trying to write more than just a funny book. He's trying to express opinion. And most especially, he makes the reader think. So the reader gets out of a book and he's thinking about a topic, for example, death or diversity when you look at The Watch.
And Rob, has he inspired you as a writer?
Well, I've always liked him because he was funny, and that kind of took off when I was trying to create some. Before I did writing and so on, I was involved with doing stand-up comedy. And I always wanted to see the funny side in serious topics because I find it's an easy way to get people to engage with them. Talking about death and talking about subjects like diversity and tension and so on, these are all things that can be quite scary to people, but if you can make them funny, you allow people to engage with them in a way that isn't necessarily threatening, but still thought-provoking. And I always thought that was very valuable.
These are big topics, Lottie, for a 17-year-old. Did you find it overwhelming or challenging or just enjoyable?
Not really overwhelming, because it's quite light-hearted to think about it in the way Terry writes it, and I just love the way he writes.
So you've all got pieces in this anthology, a tribute to Terry Pratchett. So how did you get involved, Laura?
I'm one of the organisers, actually. So Sora and the other organiser is a huge Terry Pratchett fan, and we've been talking about writing something together for a while. And then, obviously, Terry Pratchett passed, and Soren was really devastated, actually. He was really sad about it. And so, I mean, as he sort of said in his foreword, this is kind of like, you know, he was objecting to the process of mourning, or the idea of mournings. Yeah, so from there it became that we would, you know, create this anthology, which not only sort of celebrated sort of Terry Pratchett's life, but also raise funds for a charity he cared deeply about. Yeah, and then as well, because we're both indie authors, we wanted to make sure that other authors and people, even if they'd never written before, would have an opportunity to participate.
So how did you find the authors?
Online. No, we didn't go trawling through message boards. No, we put out a call for submissions on my website and on Soren's website, and then basically advertised it on social media, like on Facebook and then Reddit, and then also just through the Discworld websites and things. And we had a massive response, actually. Like, we had thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hits. And from there, hundreds of submissions. And then, of course, it was the process of going through them all and choosing the fine authors we have with us today. And, yeah, it was quite an extreme process. But I think we've produced something which we can all be proud of.
And what were you looking for in the contributions? Were you looking for something Pratchett-like or that he would have liked?
Well, we were quite open, actually. I mean, we said that we wanted something which would be on the theme of memory, but we also wanted humour. And memory's quite hard to be funny about. But because of the nature of the work, that it was going to be in tribute to Terry Pratchett, we expected that we would have quite a lot of Terry Pratchett fans. But actually, we didn't really have a lot of people imitating his style or his subjects or anything like that, which was great, because there was just a massive diversity. I mean, even in terms of the ideas, because when people send through their submission, they'd send through a sample of their writing and also what they propose to write about for the anthology. You know, no two ideas are the same. Which I guess, you know, you'll see in the book as well. No, it was fantastic.
And Michael, how does it feel to you to be part of this?
Oh, it was amazing. It was tremendous fun to work with these talented authors. And it was also a great learning opportunity. It's the first time that I've been published, and was also the first time that I had the opportunity to get feedback from writers who could tell me what is working, what doesn't work. So it was really lots of learning from Laura's editing.
And tell me a little bit about the piece of yours that's in here.
So it's a science fiction story. It's set in the distant future where mankind has long since left Earth. And it's taking place on a space station that orbits Earth, and it's the closest you can get to Earth at that point in time. The main character, Rupert, owns an antique store on the space station, and he sells objects that the last people who actually lived on Earth brought with them when they evacuated the planet. He obviously is a great fan of Earth antiques, but he isn't always entirely sure what the objects are all about. So he doesn't always get it right. And then one day he buys a strange object called a memory reader, which allows him to read stored memories from the last people who actually lived on Earth.
So was this a piece you specifically wrote for this anthology? You didn't already have it to hand?
Yeah, I wrote it. I discovered the call for submission in the Discworld Monthly newsletter at the beginning of May. And then I wrote the piece. And when I was sure I had something that would work, I submitted.
And what about you, Rob? Is your science fiction, that is the sort of genre, is it science fiction that we associate with Terry Pratchett? Is that how you describe it?
I wouldn't say that mine was science fiction necessarily, but there are a few science fiction elements to it. Mine's called Strangers, and it's mostly a sort of pseudo-detective story with a lot of comedy and playing on the tropes of it. The basic premise being that we have our young gentleman, Mr. Rigby, waking up after a night of excessive libations and drinking, only to find that he's missing his boots and various other personal effects that are quite valuable to him, and he happens to chance upon someone willing to go out of their way to help him sort of figure out, and from there, shenanigans and dark forces are on the prowl and so on.
I like shenanigans. Was this the first piece you've written?
This is my first piece of published fiction as well. I've written reviews and critiques of shows and so on before. I've done a little bit of stand-up comedy at the Edinburgh Fringe and things like that. I've always wanted to write stories and so on. It's been something that I've wanted to do for a long, long time.
So seeing it published in here must mean a lot.
Well, it's no exaggeration when I say it is a dream come true. When I first submitted my piece, I was responding to something that a friend of mine had put on a Facebook page, essentially. And I thought, why not? I basically entered it on a whim and didn't expect to get to this stage. But it's been a fantastic ride. I've learned a lot out of the experience. I'm sure Laura can tell you about all the back and forth with the editing and so on. Between the start and the finish, my story changed a lot off the back of the edits and so on. But I think the finished thing is something I can be very proud of. And I'm really glad that I got a chance to work with everyone on it.
And Lottie, you're the youngest contributor at 17. What does it mean to you to be published? Or have you been published before?
I haven't been published before. And it's so fantastic. It's amazing. I realise now that this is what I want to do later in my life. And it's... it's just amazing to be involved in something at 17. I just haven't really heard of people being like done that before, and I just appreciate it so much.
Tell us a little bit about the piece that you've written.
Mine's more fantasy, I'd say, than sci-fi. It's based around the god of memory who controls what's called the memory database, and all of the memories are stored within this database, and it's basically about what happens when people can't remember things.
And has it inspired you to write more?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I have several pieces lined up.
Laura, just listening to what's in the anthology from these three writers, I can see the links and the differences as well. You've got a nice mixture there, but with a theme.
Yeah, like it's a massive mix, like I said. Even in terms of the styles, and we've just heard sort of sci-fi, then more detective, and then fantasy as well. Because, I mean, when we were looking for pieces, we were looking for things which grabbed us and engaged us, and they had the good idea, but they also had the humour or, you know, the je ne sais quoi that would really draw our interest and hopefully that of other readers as well. Like I said, everything's different. It's just turned out fantastically and I think really well balanced as well.
And a lot of work, by the sound of it, in the editing process for you and the writers.
Yes, a lot of work. So when we did this on a very short timeline. So basically we put out a call for submissions at the end of April, and then we published it on October 31st. So it was a very, very short timeline to put an anthology, or I think a book at all. And yeah, because there were so many different people and so many different pieces and like obviously different like backgrounds of all kinds, and different writing styles too. So so I was editing the pieces except for my own. And as each of the people sitting before me know, I'm very, very thorough. Our first step was to have a peer review process, actually. So everybody had at least two of the other authors read their piece and give feedback. They then implemented that, and then it was sent to me, and then I was like, oh, I don't like this, can you change this? So it was very laborious, and so we send the pieces back and forth until we had something we could agree on, and that was what made it into the final book.
Have you had any feedback or connection with the Terry Pratchett estate at all?
Yes, well, we contacted Rhianna Pratchett, his daughter, early on in the project to sort of give her the heads up that it was something we were interested in doing. And we've heard a little bit from the estate as well. I mean, basically, they're sort of quietly condoning it at this stage. I mean, the main thing here is really raising money as well as just the tribute to Terry Pratchett. And I mean, I think at the end of the day, like, we've got a quality product which is going to raise money for this fantastic charity.
And I was speaking there to Laura May, Michael Schaefer, Robert McKelvey and Charlotte Slocum. In Memory is available on Amazon or via a special website set up to publicise the book, which is inmemorytribute.com, and all proceeds go to Alzheimer's Research UK. You're listening to Bookmark. Our studio guest is former Home Secretary Charles Clark. Charles, we were listening to that report there. Obviously, those people were inspired by Terry Pratchett. I was just wondering there, who was your inspiration in terms of politics?
Goodness, there's a question. There are two post-war politicians who've inspired me more than anyone else. But both of them, I think, arrived a bit after I got involved in politics. They're Willy Brandt, the German Chancellor, who was a very strong anti-Nazi and then became Chancellor of Germany via being Mayor of Berlin and was an inspirational figure. And the second is Mikhail Gorbachev, who may seem a rather strange person to choose. But I thought the transformation of Europe, the bringing down of the Berlin Wall and so on, were all achievements which were happened with very little bloodshed, very little conflict, in a way that brought freedom to millions of people, but no great cost. Earlier on, I suppose the individual who, before I was born, most inspired me was Attlee, because he demonstrated the capacity to make massive changes to society from a democratic political base. But I don't think he was quite as powerful for me as those two.
And at what stage did you know that you were going to be a politician?
Well, I was always involved in politics when I was at university. I joined the Labour Party shortly after I left university, actually. And I then thought I would spend my life in politics. Would I become, quote, a politician? That was a very different question. I became a councillor when I was about 35. And I suppose I then was thinking about becoming a Member of Parliament, which I became when I was 47. But I don't think I ever had an ambition from day one, I'm going to be an MP. That wasn't my top thought. My top thought was being involved in politics in a variety of different ways to try and change the society. And I think the logic that that takes you towards trying to be an MP is pretty inexorable. But I didn't really recognise it until relatively late in my life.
And did you come from a Labour Party background?
Not really. It was slightly strange. My father had been a civil servant, though I discovered quite late in my life, actually, much earlier before he joined the civil service, he had been a Labour councillor in the 1930s. But he was, through the whole of my lifetime and from before I was born, he was a civil servant and therefore not involved directly in politics. And I'm sure that my mother, who was also a civil servant, I'm sure that they developed in me an awareness of current affairs, of politics generally. But I wouldn't say I was brought up in a very partisan political environment.
So what was it that attracted you to the Labour Party in particular?
Fundamentally, because it was about trying to build a fairer society, or so I saw it. And I believed that very, very strongly. And all the ethics of my era, in that sense I'm a child of my generation. I was born in 1950. I was at university 1969 to 1972. It was an era where many, many millions of people were fighting for a fairer society. And I saw myself as part of that.
Well, we're going to come back to the Labour Party and to other inspirational leaders, but we're going to hear your second piece of music now that you've chosen, which is Search for the Hero, M People. Why this one?
I've always thought it reflected my ethic a lot. I do believe very profoundly that everybody, and I mean everybody, has a capacity to achieve things for themselves and to do better. And you asked why I was a member of the Labour Party. I felt many aspects of conservatism denied that there was that capacity to have a hero inside of you for millions of people, and thought there was only a select group who could really go forward. I thought and think that everybody has it within them. And when I first heard this song by M People, it seemed to me to express that idealism which I wanted to identify with.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today, former Home Secretary Charles Clarke. Charles, we'll move on now to this series of books that you've edited and contributed to, which looks at British political leaders. There's one for each party: British Labour leaders, British Conservative leaders, British Liberal leaders. I suppose the obvious question is, what makes a good leader?
Exactly. And I think that it's not thought about enough. I think leadership's very tough. By the way, not just political leadership, but if you're a head teacher or you're running a business or running a radio station or whatever it might be, you've got to confront difficult problems and see how you overcome it. And you don't just do it by being a brilliant, inspirational person. You've got to bring people with you, which is a very important component of leadership. But in the field of politics, I felt there wasn't enough consideration. What was it that made people good or bad political leaders? And I worked with a colleague, Toby James, who works at the University of East Anglia, and he identified five different aspects. First, to have a winning electoral strategy, which may seem very obvious, but actually there are plenty of political leaders who don't think very hard about how they win the next election, what they have to do. Second, how they manage their party, because if you have big divisions within your party, what do you do? And you can see now with David Cameron and the Conservatives on Europe and Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, there's lots of issues about how you manage your party and get people working together and not being antagonistic to each other. Thirdly, to what extent you're in tune with the spirit of the times in what you say, because if you're in democratic politics, you can only get power by being elected and by being able to have the authority of an election to carry. So if you're completely out of tune with where people are, they won't support you, won't vote for you. The fourth is government experience. People want to be confident that the people they vote for would be good and competent governors, whether it's in running the economy or dealing with international challenges or whatever it may happen to be. And the fifth is a slightly more remote thing. Can one change the rules of the game? And Cameron has done that with his English Votes for English Laws, and others have done it as well. But those are the five things we particularly looked at. We've had a lot of discussion afterwards whether those are the right five, and some would say having a vision is very, very important as well. Others would emphasise working as a team leader rather than just being an individual yourself. But what we really wanted to do with publishing these books, all of which have got a bit of analysis of what's happening, a bit of measurement of how particular leaders have performed at general elections, and then a short biography of each of the leaders to see how they compared to these kind of criteria, is to set a much more substantial discussion going about this, because we all depend on having high quality leaders.
And you worked under Tony Blair. How did he fare for you as a leader?
I thought he was a very good leader in a number of those respects I've just mentioned. I think towards the end, he became very, very convinced that he was right, and he wasn't talking more widely to people about what needed to be done, and that became a serious weakness for him in as a leader. But fundamentally, he had a capacity to be in tune with people, to articulate very well. One of the skills of leadership is articulation, and he was an extremely powerful articulator, which is still true today, even though, of course, he's a very controversial figure and many people have serious concerns about, particularly the Iraq War, but also some other aspects of his leadership. But he still today articulates very well indeed, and I'd put him very high. And in fact, in our league tables, he did very well as well.
And you weren't so kind about Gordon Brown. I've read in that you called him a deluded control freak. Is that right?
I did call him that once, yes. I don't think he's got the same qualities of leadership. It's almost a psychological thing. You need, if you're a genuinely strong leader, to be able to open yourself to other people a lot. And I don't think Gordon was able to do that. He's a highly intelligent man, a very principled man in many ways, but he wasn't able to lead people in that kind of way. And eventually that showed, both in his performance as Prime Minister and in the election defeat that Labour had in 2010.
And I have to ask you what you think of the current leadership.
Currently, as far as Labour's concerned, I don't think Jeremy Corbyn will have the capacity to lead the party to winning at the next election. If you take those criteria which I mentioned, I don't think there's any evidence that he can overcome the deep divisions within the party that there are about certain policy questions and also about his leadership itself. I don't think he's in tune with the way that most people in the country are, and so that will make it difficult for him to be an effective party leader. And I don't think he's got the experience that gives people the confidence that he's the person they can trust with running the economy and so on. So I think there's a long way for him to go. In fairness to him, I don't think that the position that the Labour Party is in today is down to him. I think it's down to the Labour Party before him not sorting out what it was and having a clear vision of where it wanted to lead the country. And in both 2010 and 2015, Labour contested the election on the basis of "Vote for us, we're not the Conservatives," which I think is not a basis to win power. As far as the other side's concerned, David Cameron has in fact been a very successful leader in terms of gaining seats and so on, and he's done better than many people thought. But of course his enormous test will be the European Union referendum coming up later this year. If he wins that, as I both hope he does and think he will, then I think his reputation will be quite strong. But of course, if he were defeated in that referendum, that would be a total, total disaster both for him and for the country.
And what about you, Charles? Could you have been a leader of the Labour Party or a Prime Minister?
I don't think I really could. I've often thought about that. It's the kind of vanity of politicians leads them to think about that. And some people have been very nice and think I could have done that. But at the bottom line, in modern politics, you've got to both be able to understand the policy questions and interrelate with the modern media in the way that you operate. You're a media performer as much as you are a decision taker. And I think that second aspect of media performer, I don't think I was as strong as I would have needed to be a successful leader. There are many aspects of the media world today with which I'm not really greatly in sympathy, and I would need to have been more in sympathy with it and working with it. I'd have loved to have had a go, but I don't think I necessarily would have been a great leader.
That's very honest of you. Do you look on the front benches now of the Labour Party? Do you see a possible successor to Corbyn?
Not at the moment. And I think that will be a key question for Labour as to whether somebody does emerge and can do that in an effective way.
OK, well, we'll come back to you. But let's shift gear slightly at the moment and hear from Mena. Mena spoke to Pilar Alessandra. Pilar is the author of The Coffee Break Screenwriter. She started her career in film as a scriptwriter for Ambling Entertainment, quickly becoming a senior story analyst. She founded her own company, On the Page, in 2001, opening a writer's studio 3 years later in California. LA Weekly recently listed her as one of the top 100 people in their Best of LA People issue. She travels the world teaching screenwriting, and Mena met up with her at the London Screenwriters Festival and reminded Pilar of a session that Pilar had taught at a previous festival about writing female characters.
It's called Beyond the Chick Flick, so that people aren't only writing chick flicks when it comes to female-driven material. And actually, that's the class that I'm about to go teach now.
I love seeing you on stage. You're so compelling. You hold a room like no one else, and you just give great material.
Thank you very much. I prepare long and hard for this festival because I want to make sure that everything is clear and that it's easy to accomplish so people can leave the class and start writing if they want to.
And you've flown all the way from LA to join us here.
I have, and after this festival, I go on to Lisbon. I'm going to be teaching to SP Television. From there, I go on to Cape Town, South Africa, and I'm going to be spending 5 days with some of the writers there through Triggerfish, which is an animation company.
So you come here every year, and then in LA, you have your own podcast that you do every week and interview people and just give us lots of tips about writing, and you also teach.
I do teach. I have a studio in Studio City. I teach 6-week classes, 1-day classes. I run private invitation-only writing groups, and I consult on scripts every day.
So you approach the psychology of being a writer as well as the specifics of writing.
Well, I try not to get too much in the head of a writer. I don't claim to be able to get inside the head of anybody. But I do think that there's usually a way to write out of your block. Yeah. There's a way to actually do something really practical toward getting back on the page. So it's not necessarily psychological, but if you can write your way through it, I think I can help.
And so you have a book called The Coffee Break Screenwriter, and the new edition is coming out next spring, April, May. Can you tell us a little more about that book?
So The Coffee Break Screenwriter, the original intention of it was to help out the busy writer, whether they're a college student or a parent or just somebody who has a really busy job, and allow them to take those little 10 minutes of coffee break time they have or any 10 minutes of free time and focus their writing so they can actually make progress in their script. This came about because I'm a mom and a teacher. I'm busy, and I kept saying, if I only had 10 minutes, just give me 10 minutes. And also in class, I would take 10 minutes and make my writers write, and they would come up with extraordinary things. So that was sort of the premise of the book. Been out for about 5 years, and now I've done a new edition that will come out in the spring that incorporates TV into it, because TV is where it's at right now, and I love TV too, so I've been teaching that, and now I'm working in some of the exercises. I'm very happy to say that The Coffee Break Screenwriter works on its own for TV, but this brings in some more TV-specific templates.
What I love about what you teach is that story is story, and whether you want to write a novel, you want to write a film, you want to write a TV show, the essential elements are very similar.
I do think so, and I think people get too caught up in what is the different structure and the different rules of their form. So actually in the second edition, I took away some of the act breaks and said, let's just call it what it is, a beginning, middle, and ending, and play with that. And I have had novelists write me and say that they use the book for breaking their story when they're starting their novel, for doing some sort of just organizing of beats, and also for even some rewrite tips, because there's ways to approach dialogue that seem to work well for novelists as well. So, yeah, I'm very pleased with that, because I have enormous respect for novel writers.
Because I started doing screenwriting first and then wrote novels, because frankly it's a lot easier to get a novel published than it is to get a movie made. But then now a lot of my readers say my novels are very cinematic. They're not very interior.
Maybe they're not overly interior. They're cinematic in a positive, active way that makes you really see the story, but you also have the advantage of writing in novel form, so I'm sure there is an interior monologue that goes on. Probably what they're saying is you don't get so much inside the brains of your character that it overwhelms the book. And having that balance is something that some novelists do want. They want it to have the pace and momentum sometimes of a feature, while also taking advantage of the fact that they can have interior monologues.
I went to a speaker yesterday, and he was saying, you know, sometimes people who don't have an experience screenwriting get upset when their novels, their favorite novels, are put on screen, and they say, oh, it's nothing like the novel, but of course it's a different beast.
It is, it is. I have to say, I get upset, you know, and because even though I know what it takes, you become so attached, again, to this interior discussion. And you don't realize that actually that's why you loved the book. Thought you loved it because of the story, but what you really loved was the fact that the character is only speaking to you. And that can be very hard to do. It's not impossible, though. I think there's a way to get the mindset of a character across visually, which is something I work on with my writers, and make you feel like you're inside of their brain. And it's a challenge, but I think it's worth taking on.
As you're talking, I'm remembering one of your podcasts, and then you're going through scripts and then just editing them and saying, well, you could change this, you could change that. And so can you tell me a bit about what led you to discovering the joy? Because you obviously have a great joy of teaching.
In a weird way, it was novels that led me to it, because back in college, you know, I would just sort of take in every single literature course that I could. I'm one of those nerds that really loved writing papers about books. And so when I moved to LA, and I was in my 20s, and I was kind of figuring out my life, a friend of mine said, hey, I remember that you always wrote these papers. I work for a movie company. Would you mind reading scripts a week and just sort of analyzing it and telling us what you think every week? And so I started doing that, then found out I could get paid for it. I'm like, I had no idea. So that was really my way in, was just having always loved analyzing and, you know, digging into great literature. I think being open to all kinds of stories and really wanting to figure out what worked and didn't work in my job was the thing that fed my passion and started me thinking about what writing tools could I develop to actually help people, and that led to teaching. And I really love teaching. I think it's so fun to be able to connect with people and to see change made in the moment. I really, really love it. So it did start with a serendipitous kind of moment, and now it is what I do and what I love to do.
And you love going to see movies, and do you go to the theater a lot in LA?
I try. Again, having kids, right, and you know how it is, and being busy. So I do this thing of trying to get all my friends who get Academy screeners so they can see it before the Oscars, and then I binge out on all those movies before the Academy Awards and sort of catch up. So I'm a little behind right now. I'm really looking forward to seeing Steve Jobs. And I'm so bummed that I'm missing the James Bond opening out here. I've managed to see every new James Bond in the past couple of years here in London. Oh. And it's completely different from seeing it in America. I mean, people show up in tuxes here, and they bring champagne, and they're just so into the movie. And I'm very upset that I won't be able to do it this time around.
So what are some of your favorite TV shows?
Oh, boy. I mean, I was definitely a Breaking Bad fanatic. Nurse Jackie was one of my favorites. I think I loved it so much because she was so flawed, and yet she was so good at her job. Yeah. And I loved seeing that balance between the two. I'm very into Bloodlines right now. I'm waiting for the second season to come out. Just finished Transparent on Amazon, which I found fascinating. Again, very, very flawed characters. I think there's a theme. So yeah, I'm a TV junkie.
Do you have any favorite British TV shows?
I got into Broadchurch big time. I really love The Fall. I caught up on that on my way to London when I was teaching TV in June. I will be back here teaching a rewrite class, two-day rewrite class. LSF is hosting it, but it's just me. And it is going to be June 11th and 12th, so if anybody is in the UK and wants to take that class, we're really going to dig into some writing tools, so I'd love to see them there. I would look for rewrite class with Pilar through the London Screenwriting Festival. Google that, it'll come up.
Is it a more intimate class, or is it like you do here with hundreds of people?
It is probably going to be hundreds of people, but as you've witnessed, make everybody stop, write, and tell me what they've got, and you can get in-class feedback, and then we move on. If anybody wants to get in touch with me through email, they should check out onthepage.tv. It connects right to my email, and I'd be happy to talk to them.
Wonderful. And your podcast?
That's, you can find everything there. Yeah, everything.
Go to Pilar's website. You'll find everything there.
Yes.
That was Mena Van Praagh talking to Pilar Alexandra again, and that website address onthepage.tv. They were talking there about television, Charles, and I was just thinking there about all the political series that they've been, The West Wing, Yes Minister, various other House of Cards. Has any of them come anywhere close to being on the nail?
I think Yes Minister's always been interesting, the relation between civil servants and politicians, quite near on the nail. West Wing, I think, was very American in its style. I don't think it tells you much about British politics. House of Cards, I still haven't finished watching the final American version. And I think it's a little too conspiratorial, really. I mean, there's too much cynicism at the core of it. I think, funnily enough, the Scandinavian ones, Borgen, for example, are more compelling. There's a French one just started called Spin, which I gather is quite interesting about this. But I don't think there are many good TV shows about British politics, actually. I think politics is too easily caricatured. People see politicians as all bad or all good in a way that doesn't quite work. But I think the Scandinavian ones particularly, I think, interesting.
And now you're not involved in politics. What are you doing now?
I do three things, really. First is I do academic work. I work at the University of East Anglia, at the University of Lancaster and at King's College London on different projects, some about politics, some about faith. I'm not a theist, but I believe faith is very important and insufficiently understood, and about the future of what the government is going to be. And then I do some work in international education, because education is obviously unbelievably important. And I think the UK is in a position where it both can learn a lot, but also teach a lot about how education can work. And British education is generally seen as very good. And I do a bit of work on migration. So I have what they call a portfolio with a range of different things. I live here in Cambridge now, and I'm delighted to do that. We've moved here just under 2 years ago. And I have a very full life.
Yes, you come back to Cambridge. You studied in Cambridge.
I did. I mean, I was a student here in the late 60s and early 70s doing maths and then economics. And other than that, I've not really been back to Cambridge except occasional visits. And so it was a bit of a risk coming to live here again. But so far it's worked extremely well.
Has it changed much since you were here as a student?
Physically it's changed. We live in the centre near what used to be called the Kite, Fitzroy Burley Street, and that was all a subject for development when I was a student, a big controversial area. Now it's there. And so physically there's been changes. I'm not sure it's changed psychologically quite as much as it needs to in some ways. It's obviously a massively dynamic growing city, but the university still sometimes I feel is slightly introverted and not really ready to appreciate the wider world in a way that I think would be beneficial.
Well, thank you very much for coming to us at Cambridge 105. We're very pleased that you're in Cambridge. It's been lovely talking to you. And those two books, the two Difficult Box and the series of books about British Conservative, Liberal and Labour leaders. Let's give that Two Difficult Box its full title. The Two Difficult Box, The Big Issues Politicians Can't Crack. In the next Bookmark, studio guest will be Gwyn Glassford. She'll be talking about her first novel, Words in My Hand, which is about the relationship between Descartes and his maid. And we'll also have an interview with Ruby Wax talking about Frazzled, which is her book on mindfulness. But we'll play out now with your last choice of music, Charles, which is Joe Hill by Joan Baez. Distinctly folky feel to most of your choices today, I have to say, but why this one?
I'm not really a very... I'm not a big music person, but I like the lyrics and I like singing, which is why they tend to be a bit like that. I suppose I've always liked Joan Baez, but in particular the Ballad of Joe Hill, because it's a constant reminder to the idealists among us that actually there is lots of conflict, and if you're wanting to achieve change, you've got to do it through determination and a preparedness to take on challenges rather than just crossing your fingers and hoping it's going to happen.
Well, thank you again, Charles. It's been a pleasure
talking
to you.